There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone. And I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that.
This is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby! That's right, this man knows what's up!
After all, these are a couple of high-stepping turkeys, and you know what to say about a high-stepper. No step too high for a high-stepper.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the beer we got? I mean, the beer we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a brave council. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, too bad.
Last question. Were you high on drugs?
Last question. Kiss my...
Oh, I get what you did there. I like that. I like that a whole bunch.
Love is a burning.
All right, 107
thing.
FM Talk, 106.5 in Midday Mobile. Hour number two. Glad to have you here on this Wednesday. Phone line, text line 343-0106, 343-0106. Cam Marston joining us in the second half of this hour, but real treat here, and I got a lot of questions lined up for our next guest. But we started talking about this morning as reports coming in overnight in the wee hours of this morning, I think four this morning, something like that, when the U.S. Geological Survey says a magnitude 4.4 earthquake struck eastern Tennessee could be felt in Atlanta. I know reports of North Alabama, Atlanta, and North Georgia Mountains, obviously the area there in East Tennessee, I guess near Fort Loudoun, near Watts Bar Lake, that area, and got us off in that discussion this morning of, you know, while there was some historical discussion of earthquakes over on the other end of Tennessee with like the New Madrid Fault and Real Foot Lake, it was a real eye-opener for me to hear they have, you know, this earthquake happening in East Tennessee. It's just not something you hear many times, but yay, 4.4 magnitude earthquake. They said about 7 miles northeast of Decatur, Tennessee. About 13 minutes later, a 3.3 magnitude aftershock struck. No reports of injuries from this, but lots of, you go on social media, a lot of stories about people going, holy cow, you know, what just happened? I live here or there, and, you know, I swear we just had an earthquake. So for some more detail and some facts on this, let's talk to Dr. Alex Beebe with the University of South Alabama, who does this stuff for a living, environmental geology, hydrology, and geophysics, joins us now. Thanks for being on.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
This is something that we're not reporting on every day, Alex. We're not reporting on earthquakes in East Tennessee.
Yeah, absolutely. This is something that kind of stands out. I mean, the rest of the country, if you're in an area that experiences earthquakes often, then a 4.4, you know, we would consider that to be a very, very light earthquake. But, you know, it's kind of anomalous for us to get earthquakes in the southeast. It's very rare for us to have these occur.
You and I were talking during the news break there, and you used a term that raised an eyebrow here. You said these would be intra-plate earthquakes. So intra versus inter. Can you explain what that means?
Yeah, so an intraplate earthquake is an earthquake that occurs kind of within one of the large plates that we have on the exterior of the Earth. Usually we see earthquakes occur where you have faults that kind of bind two plates or cause two plates to rest up against one another, and that's what you think of the Ring of Fire that basically surrounds the Pacific Ocean. But here we are, and basically getting close to the middle of the continent and having an earthquake occur where there is no plate boundary. So it's within the North American plate, in other words, which is what makes these things fairly infrequent and sometimes hard to predict where they're going to occur.
I'm just having trouble wrapping my head around that, Alex, because I've got this idea. You know, I picture, like we were taught, here are the plates, here are the different plates, and when those plates get ever so slowly, but with great kinetic force, bang up against each other, you get earthquakes, and then, you know, volcanoes and magma comes out and all those things. What's causing the rattling and rolling here with an intraplate? I mean, there's nothing banging against each other, or how does it happen?
Well, it's been a long time, but North America has gone through a number of those banging events, if you want to call them that. The Appalachian Mountains are actually a scar that we have that formed as an ocean that was once in the same location as the Atlantic Ocean closed, and we collided with Africa and Europe. And so we have this big scar on our eastern coast, the Appalachian Mountains, and those are actually filled with these old faults and fractures that have been dormant or inactive for a very long time. But occasionally you get a little bit of settling. It's kind of, I think of like a, you know, an old house, you hear a creak every now and then, and that's essentially what's happening. Some of these old faults and old fractures and planes of weakness can just slip a little bit, and they can cause the little tremors that we feel here. So it's not, like you said, it's not an active area where we're constantly sliding up against something, but we have this kind of fractured crust that will occasionally slip. And we even actually have faults that extend down to our part of the state as well. So it's not entirely uncommon to see this settling event happen. It's just, you know, the magnitudes of these earthquakes are not going to be as high as what we get on an active state boundary. Thank goodness, right?
Yeah, thank goodness. Although I remember you mentioned the ones. Is there such thing as is the Gulf Coast plate or the Gulf Coast fault or something to that effect? Because I know we've had these reports of smaller magnitude earthquakes over the years that have been somewhere off the coast or somewhere nearby here on the Gulf Coast. Is there actual line or how do you?
So, yeah, it's interesting you ask that. The Gulf of Mexico is actually was going to be a continuation of the Atlantic Ocean. It's actually part of the same crust, but for whatever reason, the Gulf of Mexico stopped opening a long time ago, and the fracturing that opened up the Atlantic Ocean continued between South America and Africa. So we're on what you would call a passive margin or a passive plate boundary. So we have our continental crust here, you know, where the land is on the Gulf Coast, and then if you go into the Gulf of Mexico, that's what we call oceanic crust. And there is a boundary between the two, but it's passive. There's no subduction or sinking of crust. There's no plates colliding, in other words, and that means that there's, you know, fairly infrequently, there's no earthquakes that we really see associated with the contact between the plates, and there's no volcanoes as well. Typically, when we have plate boundaries, it's not uncommon to see volcanic activity as well.
So what about, you know, talking about these ancient faults, reactivation, is there any example of something that was long since dormant that gets reactivated? I mean, could that ever come back? Could there be an area? Could there be a new ring of fire sometime in the long future and history of our planet? Like a new place that we're talking about is the ring of fire.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the thing. When we talk about geology, we're typically talking about really long time scales here, and the plates are moving at on average about the same rate in which your fingernails grow. So it will take a while, but right now, the way things are going, the Pacific Ocean is actually closing. It's getting smaller, it's shrinking, and as a result, that's where you see the ring of fire surrounding it. And the Atlantic Ocean is growing bigger, so you would assume if we just extrapolate from today, you know, where we're going in the future, eventually the Pacific Ocean will run out of space and you'll start to see the continents collide around there. Of course, a lot of things can happen, you know, different oceans can open up and kind of change the trajectory of the continent. But this is something that is constantly happening. The plates are in constant motion. And when you add, you know, geologic time, you're going to see, you know, a lot of dynamic activities and a lot of different mountain forming events that continue to occur. That's what we see in the past as well.
Coming right back, more of our discussion with Dr. Alex Beebe from the University of South Alabama. Also, some texts coming in with questions. You can line them up at 343-0106. We'll talk about this more and talk about the history of there have been some of those big earthquakes here in the center of the continent. We were talking about one of them this morning, and the doctor will explain that and a whole lot more when we get back. Y'all stay close.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, 120 FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile. Glad to have you here on this Wednesday. And a reminder, too, Our nomination program, our process, still open for our Alabama end of the year, but pretty soon we close down the nomination, we start seeding the brackets, and you know how we let you vote from now through the end of the year to decide our Alabama end of the year. You can drop those suggestions to our text line, to the Facebook page, or the Twitter feed. We'll talk more about that coming up. I want to continue our conversation with a band that does this every day. Look at it, what's going on with earthquakes and environmental geology, hydrology, geophysics. Dr. Alex Beebe from the University of South Alabama, our guest, and we are talking about the stemming off. Me bothering you today, Alex, on the phone was stemmed off that earthquake in Tennessee last night. Did get my attention. That is a kind of a different thing. Ben, you said this was intraplate, not interplate.
That's right. Yeah, these are basically old fractures and faults that formed a long time ago that are, for the most part, dormant, but occasionally they get reactivated and a little bit of slipping can occur. And cause these earthquakes to pop up fairly infrequently and kind of spread out over a larger area.
And I was looking at some of the text coming in here. This one actually is going to be good to transition into the discussion I had this morning when I heard there was a Tennessee earthquake, and I was pointing out that was in East Tennessee versus West Tennessee, that New Madrid fault that created Real Foot Lake. And I have a text here from David. He said, when I was in elementary school in Memphis, in the Memphis area, a world-renowned earthquake expert predicted the New Madrid fault line was going to erupt. We practiced our earthquake drills by getting under our desks. Would that actually help?
I've got to say, I mean, it can't hurt, right? I mean, I'm not sure what else to do in that situation, especially with the New Madrid earthquake, the magnitude of the ones back in the early 1800s. You know, you're talking about severe catastrophic damage, and so I guess that may be the first instinct is to duck and hide.
Yeah, how do you figure out, you know, almost like forensically, how big those earthquakes were? I mean, I reported this morning, I remember reading that they felt that quake that created Real Foot Lake there on the New Madrid Fault as far away as Quebec. Does that tell you anything? Can you look at that and go, okay, then that must have been a 6 or a 5 or a 7, or does that mean anything to you?
Yeah, that's actually the way it's done for these older earthquakes that kind of predate the technology that we have today, where we can quantitatively look at a seismograph or an earthquake and we can see how intense the shaking was. We actually have another scale. Everybody might be familiar with the Richter scale, but there's another scale called the Mercalli scale, which is based upon just that. How much shaking was felt by people, how much damage was caused, how far was that damage away from the epicenter, and how far away could people feel the shaking. And it's not exact, but it does give us a pretty good idea. You know, we have had enough earthquakes now with our technology, our seismometers today, that we can correlate the Mercalli scale back to some of these older events.
We talk about older events, too. During the news break, we talked about it. I was really focused on kind of the history of Real Foot Lake and that earthquake back in 1812, but then you pointed out later on in the 1800s another big one hitting in the South. Where was that?
There was one in 1886 in Charleston. It was about magnitude 7 earthquake. So again, you know, these are anything over a 6, we would say is kind of a catastrophic earthquake. So you get up to a, you know, magnitude 7, that's 10 times as much shaking there. So versus a 6. So magnitude 7, that's a very extreme earthquake, and definitely something that stands out, again, as being an anomaly, something we don't necessarily expect, because it's in Charleston, South Carolina, which is on a passive plate contact, but not really, you know, kind of like what we have on the West Coast, not really an active area.
Yeah, I guess it's worth pointing out, too, you touched on it, but like we deal with in hurricanes and tornadoes and things, it's not incremental, these levels, it's logarithmic, correct?
That's exactly right, yeah. So a 7 would be 10 times as much shaking as a 6, and a 7 would be 100 times more shaking than a magnitude 5. So what was felt today in Tennessee, 4.4, and then followed by the aftershock, a little bit low magnitude, you know, that's well below 6, but you're kind of getting at the threshold where, you know, people can feel it, and maybe you hear some rumbling and some shaking, you hear dishes shake and things like that, but usually we don't see a lot of damage associated with earthquakes below, you know, 5 or 6 is kind of the threshold for when it starts getting much more severe.
You hear stories coming out of places after earthquakes. You just had one in the around 7 right there in Alaska near Anchorage, and you see the destruction afterwards. But you hear accounts, and maybe it's Hollywood movies too, that the ground during an earthquake, certain earthquakes, actually, and I'm going to use the wrong term, it becomes liquid or becomes not solid. Is that just your eyes deceiving you, or does that happen?
It can certainly happen. In fact, we've got another geologist at the department who studies liquefaction is what it's called, where the ground will shake and you actually end up with this kind of slurry, almost like quicksand that can form and cause buildings to just sink.
But this was previously, before the earthquake, you could take an area that's hard ground, hard, like regular hard ground, and the earthquake hits and that ground gets like a slurry.
It's
hard to understand
what the shaking can do. It's almost like a just really kind of rapidly shaking everything, and you have fluid in between the grains of sediment or the rocks there that can cause things to just turn into mush, basically, while the shaking is occurring.
This is what, by the way, too, my buddy Cam Marston, who's getting ready to come on with us here after the bottom of the hour news break, is like me, interested in a lot of this stuff. Cam, you had a question for Dr. Beebe.
I'm curious if the fracking technology that I've learned about in a number of my conversations can be, if any of the earthquakes are attributable to the fracking technology, which has benefited our nation so much from the energy dependency. What is your opinion on the correlation of those two things?
Well, it's a question that gets brought up quite a bit whenever these earthquakes occur, in these interplate earthquakes, because you kind of start looking at, well, what could cause an earthquake to occur where there's no plate boundary or no active plate boundary? And I think, there is good evidence, strong evidence in the literature that humans have changed the amount of shaking we have in certain areas or the seismicity. And probably the best example is over in the state of Oklahoma. There's been a significant increase in the frequency and magnitude of earthquakes over the past 10 or 20 years. And as it turns out, looking into it a little bit more, it's not necessarily the hydraulic fracturing or what we think of when you inject fluids down into heavily cemented rocks like shales to try and open up conduits to extract oil or natural gas. It actually turns out that more likely the earthquake activity in Oklahoma can be attributed back to wastewater disposal, which is still, it's related to the petroleum industry, but they take this byproduct water that they get from oil and natural gas extraction, and it's very heavily contaminated. It's too expensive to treat. It's very difficult to use, so it actually is legally reinjected back into the ground, and in some situations, it's injected into areas that can actually fail and cause earthquakes to occur, or at least increase the probability for an earthquake to occur.
This question here, and I mentioned those two back-to-back, this one, can an earthquake in one area, like the one in Alaska, be a triggering mechanism for a seismic event in another area, like Tennessee?
That's another good question, and there, it depends. I think it's a lot easier to predict where an earthquake is likely to occur versus when it's going to occur, but, it does seem like, at least as long as I've been watching the seismometer that we have on the university, we pick up earthquakes worldwide, and it does seem like, you kind of get these chains of earthquakes that occur. So we just had the earthquake in Alaska not too long ago, and now this activity. There's probably no relation between the two. It could just be, that there's more interest and more people following earthquake stories when something hits, the U.S., like the Alaskan earthquake. So I guess it depends, would be my answer.
If you, being a geologist in the Deep South, would you choose a Category 4 hurricane or a number 7 on the Richter scale earthquake?
Oh, my goodness. You're putting me in a tough position because I'm actually in an earth science department where we have meteorologists, and we're both kind of watching these things. I hope that either one of those events will stay away from populated areas, but I've never actually experienced an earthquake personally. It's always been kind of a weird dream of mine, to see just the energy associated with the ground shaking and plates moving past one another or whatever mechanism causes it. I guess I'm an earthquake guy.
Well, this has been a great discussion. I sure appreciate your time with us. And listen, if we have something else happens, more rumbling, I'm gonna dial you up.
Absolutely.
Great stuff, and I appreciate making time for us, Dr. Alex Beebe from the University of South Alabama, talking about a lot of stuff with earthquakes and this area we consider to like be an earthquake desert, right, down here. But last night, East Tennessee, 4.4 magnitude earthquake with a 3.3 magnitude aftershock on that one. So I thought it was worth talking. There's a lot of, I mean, that 1886 Charleston earthquake, I mean, that's kind of news to a lot of folks, too. The history of this in the South is not one that, I don't know, we don't sit around the kitchen table and talk about, but it's pretty cool stuff.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating. I think it's exciting to think something like that could hit, but I hope it doesn't.
Yeah, I'm going to go with the second part of that. That is Cam Barson from What's Working. When we come back, we'll talk about tonight's show and some broader subjects as well. Some shaking going on out there in the economy, right? Earthquake in the economy. There's my bad segue. We'll be right back.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, 135 FM Talk 106.5, Midday Mobile on this Wednesday. Glad you're along. Remember, the nominations open right now for Alabamian of the Year. Let me just triple down on this. So here's the thing with Alabamian of the Year. It is a complete ripoff of Time's Person of the Year, except I think Time really dropped the ball here recently with Person of the Year. So another show, we'll get into talking about that. But what I'm getting to is, it's not just, and I appreciate the positive nominations and all those great stories that are coming in. That's good. And you can keep those up. But what the task is here is to find that person, that group, that thing. Yes, y'all have led it to animals. Once again, the critter, whatever it is that has most influenced the news cycle in 2018 in the state of Alabama. So it could actually be somebody who's not even from Alabama, but they did something. They moved here. They did something. It could be for good. Could be for bad. It's the thing that has most influenced the news cycle and our lives as Alabamians in 2018. So you nominate the people like we've done in the past, and we get all the nominees in. We seed the brackets starting next week, and we'll put them up just like March Madness, and we'll let them play. When they play, that's y'all's votes, and then we'll winnow down the list by the end of the month to the Alabamian of the Year to be revealed probably the first week in 2019. So it's a process that y'all are – it is transparent, unlike Time, because y'all put the nominees in, then y'all vote for the nominees. All we sit back and do is tell y'all who's winning and not, and Dalton has to build the brackets, which is kind of a pain, but he's good at it. So keep those nominations coming in on our text line, 343-0106, 343-0106 on the text line. Just put Alabamian of the Year or something to that effect so we know what you're talking about there. If you go to my Twitter feed, at FM Talk 106.5, give me like a hashtag Alabamian of the Year or Alabamian of the Year 2018, something like that. Helps me curate all those nominations. And then if you want to hit us up on the Facebook page, facebook.com/FM Talk 106.5. There's a pin status. In other words, it's up at the top of the stack. Go there, drop it in there too, and then we will get them all, you know, because there's duplication, and this, so we'll have to get those all together over the weekend, and we'll debut our first round coming up next week. All right, you heard him a second ago. It's our buddy Cam Marston. What's Working, of course, tonight at 6 o'clock. Thanks for being here.
Happy to, always. Thank you for the invitation.
Hey, do you know you get in on an earthquake conversation here? We're going to talk economy, and we're going to do that, but you got in on geophysics at the same time.
Never know what to expect when I come through the door.
Sure. At this place, right? I want to talk about tonight's show and then the broader discussion. First of all, who's your guest tonight?
A guy who I can't get enough of. His name is Peter Ricchiuti. Peter is the economist at Tulane University at the Freeman School of Business. Peter and I know one another from meeting each other on the road, giving presentations years ago, and we managed to maintain a friendship and a connection. And when the stock market started gyrating really wildly several months ago,
7.0 on the on the stock market scale, yes,
I reached out to Peter to say, hey, can I put you on the show and try to make heads or tails of this thing? It's not going one way or the other. It's going every way, every other day.
Volatile is an understatement, yeah.
He agreed and gave some, you know, some perspective to it.
All right, because that's, you know, one of the things we've been talking about on this show for, well, we talk about money issues a good bit on this show, but yeah, the volatile nature and the down cycle we're in, you always wonder, when that tipping point is, that it's not just a correction, you know, it's going to be something bigger. At the same time, you know, I'm always interested in the what I see is a disconnect, and I think the disconnect between Wall Street and Main Street showed up in 2016, too, with the people showing up to vote for then-candidate Trump, now President Trump. I think there's that disconnect sometimes, too, when you look at Main Street, and you deal so much with business, small business entrepreneurs, mid-sized business, big businesses as well. We do as well, and I see positivity. The economy is doing good. People are, you know, expanding their businesses. People have gotten raises. All these good stories come out. Not that there's not exceptions, because there truly are, and we can get into some of those. But this positivity, and then you look at Wall Street acting like it is, and you're like, where's the disconnect? Because there's been times when Main Street economy is tough, but Wall Street's charging. Yeah. And a simple guy like me sits back and goes, what the heck? What's missing?
That's right. And I asked Peter early on in the show, What is the measurement? What is the marker that you look at most frequently to determine what's going on in the economy? His answer, I look at the indexes. I look at the S&P, and I look at the Russell 1000, mm-hmm. one that I was not familiar with. Mm-hmm. These indexes, he said, are a look of 6 to 9 months out. They predict 6 to 9 months out. So when we see volatility in the stock market today, it means that the predictors, that the people that are reading the tea leaves, the deep readers of the tea leaves, are saying 6 to 9 months is going to get crazy. We don't know what it's going to be. So a small business like me, a small business like you, we're mostly reacting to the way the phone rings. Let's mm-hmm. face it. We're putting out the hottest tire that's closest
right
now.
Yeah, real time, yeah.
And it may feel good. It may feel bad. Right now, we're, you know, that small business, all business seems to be going well.
Mm-hmm.
But according to these, quote, unquote, master tea leaf readers, 6 to 9 months from now, things are going to get crazy.
And I, you know, I follow this, and as a rank amateur here, I've been involved in equities quite a bit of time, and you know, I do things on a contrarian basis. Like I've told everybody on the show, I pretty much got out of individual stocks, not retirement stuff, but individual stocks. I got out in January because everybody was excited and happy, and yeah. I can't stand that, so I got out. And now that everybody's running for the doors, now you see what pages are open on my computer over here. I'm watching stocks all day, looking for bargains. That's just my nature. But you talk about the long term, and I'm always going, hey, I'm a sheep to the slaughter. There's a bunch of wolves there. They know so much more than I ever could. Those tea leaf readers from that are 6 or 9 months off. But then I see something like last week. So week before, the president goes, has this meeting with Xi Jinping. On that Monday following, the bulls came out on the market.
Yeah.
A lot of buying, a lot of green.
Yeah.
People buying, everything's good. We're going to get this deal, which, by the way, if story's been underreported, I think, because of the Cohen thing and all that, but China has backed off some of their tariffs on vehicles, so I think there's a positive story that has not been talked about yet. But you get all this exuberance on a Monday because of some dinner that, you know, happened between the president and the head of China, and then the next day, on Tuesday, they said, well, we don't think the deal is going to happen, everybody sell. That's the thing. I mean, the long-term tea, I understand the cooking in and the baking in, the built-in of the market going forward, but a day-to-day story like that, it seems schizophrenic to me.
Well, I think, and we talk about this in the show, we've got a parallel between the news cycle and the announcements out of the executive office. Never before have they been so closely united to one another. And it was Trump that came out and said, we've called off the tariffs with China for 90 days, I mm-hmm. think it was. And then we saw people buying. And then he came back within a handful of days and said, I'm the tariff king. Something along those lines.
Yeah, it was a tweet. I mean, yeah, like a daily tweet from the president.
Right. There aren't enough tariffs to make me happy.
Right, I'm a tariff man, he said.
Yeah.
But, you know, let me argue the flip side of this. He said that in 2016 when he was running for office. He said it in 2017 after being elected. Said it in 2018 as the president.
But on the heels of all this, an undertone of all this, is we've had one of the longest economic expansions in our time.
Mm-hmm.
And all these tea leaf readers are saying, we're due for a correction. We're due for a correction.
Oh, is it a correction, though? That's the question.
Good question.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're due for something to change. And then somebody comes in and throws a little gasoline on the fire and says, I'm a tariff man. They're like, all right, there it is. There it is. Everybody react quickly. So this first time ever, a president berating the Federal Reserve,
mm-hmm.
a president announcing himself, not only a president, this is fascinating to me, a Republican president. Mm-hmm. I was listening to your show on the way in. Mm-hmm. We got Republicans in Alabama saying we're going to install a lottery.
Yeah.
We've got a Republican president saying I'm all for tariffs. I can't find enough of these things.
Right.
We've seen this pendulum go so far the other way, it makes your head spin. And all these tea leaf readers are saying the correction is coming. We don't know when it's coming. It's right around the corner. And then somebody says something that, oh, that's it. That's it. That's going to trigger the recession or the correction or whatever. We got to stay ahead of it. So there's a nine-month look, and there's a reaction, an instantaneous reaction to the tweets.
So the nine-month look, one based, I'm sure, on a lot of crunching of numbers, knowing the history of the market. Because this is not even a discussion of the individual merits of, which drives me crazy. People quit looking at the individual merits of companies they're buying shares of and start looking at other things. And you know, that's where they lose me. I'm like, is it a good company? Do they make a good thing people want to buy? But that part, that 9 month, has that number crunching in it. That day-to-day stuff's nothing. That's raw emotion, man.
It is raw emotion. It's reflexive. It's raw emotion. You're right. And we are all vulnerable to it, particularly these affluent, let's say, mutual funds who can mm-hmm. buy and sell in the tens of millions of dollars with the flip of a switch.
Mm-hmm.
They see the market sees a big drop in the mutual fund or big sell, and it frightens people, and they all react.
Okay,
yeah.
So tonight, starting at 6, it's Peter Ricchiuti.
Peter Ricchiuti. What's working with Cam Marston with Peter Ricchiuti? We talk about the economy. We focus on, as well, industries that are important to the Deep South. We get into oil and gas.
Uh-huh.
It's called the. Peter talks about the fact that there's not been a new well drilled in the Gulf of Mexico in a long time, and because they cost $1 billion, I didn't know mm-hmm. that $1 billion to drill a new well. That's a B, the mm-hmm. letter B, $1 billion. But he also has, and I'm a big fan of what he does, it's called the Birken Road Report. And he's got 200 students in his class at any one time, divided up in groups of five, and they go study publicly traded companies in the Deep South. And there's a fund, the Birken Road Fund, that reflects these companies, and he says they outperform the market every time, because part of the MBA that he leads his students through is to study these companies and what their opportunities are.
There's a fund with some Southern drawl to it.
There is.
The Birken Road. Okay,
the Birken Road Fund.
I'll be looking at that there during the break. You hang out with us for a little bit. Coming right back, more with Cam Marston tonight, 6 o'clock. What's working? We'll also talk about, if you missed the show, how you can get it online. The podcast is out there waiting for you. Plus, you can go binge listen to shows in the past.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, 150, FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile. Y'all say hello to my buddy Angelo at Mobile Bay Coins. Hey, Angelo.
Hey, how's it going, Sean?
Going good. And let me say a side note, before we get into all the fine jewelry and gift ideas, let me talk about one of them. So I picked up when I came and checked out the Open L knife selection when I was doing the show there Friday, found an Open L that I didn't already have, and that thing has been, it was riding in my pocket, riding in my truck. It has not been very far away from me since Friday. Which one was that? What's that one called?
That was the number 8 Outdoor, which is another really cool knife in my mind because it is a stainless steel blade and a polymer handle, and unlike a lot of stainless steel knives out of there, this one actually holds a darn edge. So many stainless steel blades,
right.
You cut one thing with it, and then all of a sudden it's a butter knife.
So that is one of just many designs of the Open L's that people need to come in and check out. But let's talk about other gift ideas as well, because if somebody wants to get something engraved, customized, make that great gift, they need to start thinking about it and coming by now.
Well, they certainly do. We have all those cool Christmas rounds and Christmas bars, and we have the holders where you can turn that piece of silver, not only personalized, but turn it into an ornament. Put it into that holder, hang it on the Christmas tree. It makes a very, very cool Christmas ornament, as well as an awesome gift. We have all sorts of beautiful pieces of jewelry. Actually have a new diamond shipment coming in sometime today. I'm sort of on pins and needles right now, waiting for it to show up. Earrings, tennis bracelets, rings, you name it. All sorts of cool diamonds coming in today.
Good stuff, Angelo. Give people directions to come see you in person, or if they're maybe at their desk right now and they're going to cheat a little bit and get a little advanced look, how do they find you online?
Yeah, online they can go to mobilebaycoins.com or like and follow us on Facebook. That's always the first place to see the new pictures of items coming in. If you want to see us in the real world, 2204 Government Street, right here in Midtown.
Hey, thanks, Angelo. We'll see you soon.
Have a good one, Sean.
Hey, you too. Angelo checking in from Opal Bay Coins. Continuing our conversation with Cam Martian, what's working. And, of course, tonight's show at 6 o'clock. But if people want to go back and binge listen, or if they don't catch tonight's show, they can do the podcast thing.
Yeah, the podcast is available. Go to cammarston.com. And across the top of the page, we have the podcast link. Click on it, and you can hear all the shows back there. And we've begun talking about the Peter Ricchiuti show, The Economy Right Now. And it is... people have found it surprisingly interesting. There's no, it's hard to find.
What do they call economics? The stale science or something like that.
There's
always,
yeah.
But I'm fascinated by it. But I'm a weirdo. So
I am too. Yeah. And I hear a lot of economists speak at the different conferences that I go to. And 99 of out of 100 of them are pretty dull people, quite frankly. Extraordinarily intelligent,
right?
But not great at delivering content. Peter is the exception, and you hear that on the show. And he's been downloaded a lot in a very short amount of time that he's been up there, and I've had a lot of comments from Peter's insights.
Let's talk about you know, what you do every day with your business. You are couldn't be more involved. People say, oh, I'm in business, but you're in business for business with what you do.
I'm trying to help my clients solve some of the challenges that they deal with on a regular basis, mostly around people right now. That's where my, mm-hmm. my focus is recruiting and retaining people.
It's a big deal right now. People can't get, I mean, you hear, I mean, we're running more commercials now for recruiting some days than anything else.
Yeah, and I think it's a reflection of the economy. The economy's booming. There's nobody to hire. That's what's limiting the economy from growing a little bit more. Mm-hmm. Going back into our conversation a little bit earlier, the reason it won't continue to go, says the economist, is there just simply aren't enough people to hire to push the business forward.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? You got to imagine, if somebody can't get a job today, what's wrong with that guy?
That's right. Good point. And so in your business, you're helping businesses retain the people they do have, right?
Recruit and retain people. We study the trends that businesses are learning out there to best recruit and retain people. And we segment them by age oftentimes. This is what an under 35-year-old is looking for in a job, in a incentive plan, the way they like to be coached. Here's somebody over the age of 55. This is what they're generally looking for. So we work with the employers on retention strategies of their workforce, as well as working with employers on strategies to recruit new people to their workplace.
Well, and that's, I mean, maybe one and the same, right? You have the right kind of environment that helps you. I mean, I always use the term, helps you poach employees from other people.
Yeah, and that's what it's led to. That's right. There's an extraordinary amount of poaching going on based on the perks that a workplace will offer, the coaching the workplace offers. We know for sure, for example, that mentoring the next generation of employee drives retention rates up by both the mentor stays longer as well as the young employee stays longer. They both feel more engaged with their workplace when they're in mentoring relationships. But one of the challenges is people are so busy today that mentoring falls by the wayside. Mm-hmm. We can't hire new people. There's too much turnover. We don't have enough time to mentor. Well, something's got to give. Something's got to give. You got to, and my encouragement always is, let's find time to mentor this next generation if you want to drive your retention rates up. Find the time.
Now, as you look forward into doing this, if things start changing, you run out of, I mean, it seems like it will just be more and more important. I mean, it's very important today for recruiting and retention. But if what Ricchiuti is saying is correct, it will be logarithmically magnified going forward.
There you go. Very well. Very good. Yeah. Which gets into another politically hot topic is immigration. If I'm a builder, if I'm a home builder and I need labor, and I got 10 people that want to build new homes, but I don't have enough labor for it, what do I really feel about this immigration thing? Because there are people coming through that want to work. So it's amazing how interconnected all these arguments can be.
I wonder if it changes if more people are available to work those jobs for more money going forward, that maybe doing something else now that, you know, my favorite subject, that the robots will take the other jobs and then these people can take the other, you know, the jobs that will be demanded.
I think the robots are a part of our future. When Me you talk too. About just hundreds of thousands of square feet of warehouse space with four people in there, mm-hmm. and a robot that doesn't break up with his girlfriend, you're like, yeah, give me another robot.
That's right.
give me another robot.
Y'all know, see, I'm not the only one. I've been talking about this for years. It's the people who think, oh, it's going to be the Roombas vacuuming our house. Okay.
Yeah.
Talk to me in 10 years. See where that goes.
When's the last time you pulled up behind an 18-wheeler on the road that did not have an advertisement on the back, drivers needed?
Yeah.
And we wonder...
That'll change with AI.
Guys scrambling to create trucks that'll go coast to coast.
They're not doing it because they just think it's cool.
No, it's not cool. And we talk about that in the show. Peter's got a great insight into that in the show. It's really fascinating what's going on out there. And I'm in the weeds daily. I don't see it. But it's you get a perspective like his from 100,000 feet, and you think, whoa, this is going to be pretty cool.
All right. Tune in tonight, 6 o'clock, What's Working. Or if they don't check it out there, they can go to...
CamMarston.com. Look for the podcast link at the top of the page.
Good stuff. 158. We're going to wrap it up for today. Be back tomorrow morning. For Mobile Mornings, Paul Feinbaum on the way next. Remember, check us out online, fmtalk1065.com.